welcome to the L.A. Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo. And kind of getting into that song, that's our new opening.
Yeah, I kind of like
Swagger.
It. It's called Swagger?
Swagger.
Yeah, it's really a very neat song.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
Yeah. So, anyway, tonight we got some news and views and some interesting things. And
we'll have a little more time to do some health news.
Yeah,
we didn't have much time really last night to read a lot of things on our other show.
Yeah, Tuesday nights, even though it's a long period, it's kind of tied up with a lot of different
with interviews and people. You know,
yeah.
We have usually we have two regular guests plus we have an interview.
So it takes up the time and we try to do as much as we can. But I wanted to tonight we want to do the same thing, but only in an hour format and kind of concentrate. Concentrate, right?
A little bit on the health news. We want to do a little more of that.
Yeah, so that's what we're going to do tonight.
But just bear with us a minute, and we'll be with you.
Yeah. Okay, right.
Get to our news here. Sometimes it takes a little longer than we anticipate. And since we're doing this show at home, my cat's going to help.
Yeah, okay. What the hell happened to my... Okay. Well,
Well,
I think we'll go to that. I wanted to do the last section on that, but let me do this.
So just get to what we need to get to.
Yeah, I am. I have it bookmarked, but I can't find it.
It was probably one of the last things that you bookmarked. That
you would think so, but it wasn't.
David, I quit.
Yeah, it's not the one.
There we are.
Yeah. All right. So there we go. And I guess the same thing's happening in England. That's happening around there. They're affecting the cops in England.
Because it says Theresa May, police must accept pay cut or lose jobs. On pay and conditions, Mrs. May said that in all likelihood there would be a 2-year pay freeze in police, saving £350 million. No Home Secretary wants to cut police officers' pay packages, she said, but with a record budget deficit, these are extraordinary circumstances. In a document by the Association of Chief of Police, which outlined potential savings in August, members suggested scrapping a host of additional payments and bonuses, as well as reducing the amount of overtime paid for working on public holidays.
So that's what's happening in there. Okay, this is kind of freaky. This is happening in Australia. That they just rolled out a new deep penetrating radiation scanners at the airports.
Jeez.
Yeah, this is Australia.
The next generation of body scanners to be rolled out in airports will literally be able to see inside the human body as security personnel gear up to trial machines that use deep, penetrating radiation, the same kind used in hospitals to examine internal organs and bones. Australian airports are set to begin using the devices should legislation before federal parliament be passed, enabling customs officers to use technology previously only operated by doctors in controlled conditions.
The justification for the technology is to crack down suspected drug smugglers who swallow illegal substances to evade airport security. However, the notion of placing the technology along airport security lines paves the way for its general use, particularly in light of the recent security theater explosion we have seen in airports over the last 18 months. But they
security theater.
But the bizarre part about this is,
the little
amount of stuff you can put in up your butt or down your throat
isn't going to kill anybody.
It'll kill the person carrying it maybe, but it's
ridiculous.
I mean, this is a sick sickness. I'll tell you, the security jazz. This is an article I'll go to. This is okay, but. The article is a little more clear.
In less than 30 days, you'd be required to carry an ID card?
That's what they're saying, yeah.
Even though no one on Capitol Hill is talking about it, unless it is stopped, the provisions of the Real ID Act of 2005, Public Law 109-13, through the Department of Homeland Security, will require the federalization of state-issued driver's licenses by May 11, 2011. This is the type of card the Nazis and the Communists and the Soviet Union made people carry. The new cards, disguised as uniform driver's licenses, will be biometric. Each card will store up to a gigabyte of personal data about the cardholder and will contain a GPS tracking chip. So that means the government will know where you are at all times.
No one is talking about this, and certainly this is something that the Obama administration would like to keep quiet. Barack Obama's America is quickly becoming Nazi Germany. Did you ever think you would experience invasive Big Brother tactics in which uniformed officers ask, "Let me see your papers"? I know Barack Obama doesn't care what the U.S. Constitution says, so we have to care, and we have to stop him. And this battle is not waged and won by May 11, 2011. The American people will be carrying a federal ID card that will double as a state-issued driver's card license. You will need it to vote. You will need it to enter a federal building. You will need it to buy a plane ticket. And believe it or not, you will need it if you are stopped while jogging in the park or sitting on your front porch. Oh, yes, and because it's your driver's license as well, you will need it to drive your car.
You may be wondering how in the world we could have allowed this to happen. We allowed it to happen because we were more concerned about terrorists than civil liberties. Congress passed the Real ID Act on May 11, 2005, creating a mandatory national standard for state-issued driver's licenses, making the data points identical on all cards. Real ID requires state driver's licenses authorities to use more stringent measures to verify social security numbers, birth dates, addresses, proof of citizenship, and immigration status. The Act prescribes 18 separate security controls that states are now required to use when issuing driver's licenses.
Before a Real ID can be issued, the applicant must provide the following documentation: a photo ID that includes his or her full legal name and birth date, documentation of birth date, your birth certificate, documentation of legal status and social security number, and third party documentation showing name and place of residence. Freaking unbelievable. Does that surprise you or not?
No, what's it say here?
There's a little video that goes with this.
Let's see what the audio has to say.
The Real ID, or the Real ID Act, is a national ID card that will contain a data chip that will contain your social security number, your political status, health records, firearm registration if you have one, police records, fingerprints, and your retina scan. Also, a corporation would be allowed to require you to have the national ID card or the Real ID to shop at their store, or to fly on a plane, or to open a bank account, or to buy a gun, or to drive a car, or enter a federal building. Now, the Real ID Act is going to go to a state-by-state vote. It's already been through the Senate, and it was passed 100-0.
Oh.
And it went through Congress, and it was almost unanimously passed there also. The bad news is John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama all passed the Real ID Act. Now, the only person that ran for president and voted against it was Ron Paul. The worst part is even if your state decides not to have the Real ID, you will not be able to fly on a plane to another state. You won't be able to enter a federal building, and you will not be able to drive in another state. And that's if your state turns it down. Most states are going to vote for it. And eventually, maybe, some are speculating that the chip that is already in the new passports supposedly tracks you would be put in the national ID card. But you could be tracked even with the new one as it is said to be, as it's going to be created, because you just would have to come in within a certain distance of a receiver and it would track that you're at the Walmart at, you know, 4:30 p.m. on December 2nd or whatever, and it would go into the states' databases that they're going to have for all the information that is going to be in these chips. And if you, instead of tapping your phone, they can just tap your card, and they can, well, they can tap your phone also, but they can just track wherever you go, whatever you buy, whatever you have, and, you know, it's almost anything, and they can find it out within seconds. It'll just be in a giant database with no warrant needed to find out almost everything about you.
I don't know who the other two people are. There was a picture, and Leo and I identified Bloomberg and Pataki, but we didn't know who the other...
And Rockefeller.
Rockefeller, but I didn't
know... David Rockefeller, but the other guy, I wasn't sure who it was. I
didn't know who that was.
So anyway...
Pretty scary.
Yeah, it is scary. It is really, really scary. And this is... I don't know how long this is. I'll check it out, but this is... This is part one.
Does common law still exist? There are three types of law: statutes or written law, common law, and administrative law. So is common law common or not? Well, the question should be, does common law still exist? And if so, how is it important? Well, the answer to the aforementioned question is that common law does indeed exist and is fully recognized by the state and federal courts. The term common law is itself very common, but most people don't know exactly where it stems from or even when to use it. Common law is simply unwritten, judge-made law as opposed to written or statutory law. The courts always likes to act like common law doesn't exist or that it is some kind of rhetoric. For example, in a hearing on June 30th, 2003 A.D., before Judge Hugh Lawson, United States District Judge, presiding in Macon, Georgia, the judge asked Attorney Manny Arora, "Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Arora. Are you telling me, as counsel for this man, as officer of this court, that you believe these positions you are presenting the court have legal merit?" And Manny Arora immediately replied,
"Judge, based on what I've seen in my limited time reviewing these documents, I know the court made us aware of some of these documents. A lot of them deal with UCC and common law type issues that I'm not familiar with. I do not know if there's merit or not merit with these positions."
This is where Judge Lawson abruptly interrupts Mr. Arora. Now let's take a look at what he says. Judge Lawson interrupts,
"Mr. Arora,"
he says angrily. Mr. Arora replies,
"Yes, sir,"
with a scared, shaky voice. Then Judge Lawson goes on to say, while intimidating, pointing his finger at Mr. Arora,
"You have a duty to this court not to present frivolous or spurious matters in support of the position. Your client..."
Which was proven earlier that Mr. York is not his client.
"I'm warning you, you're going to be in serious trouble with the court if you violate that rule."
Boy, such force. Why do you think Judge Lawson was so angry about this? I mean, really, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal. Here's why. Because UCC and common law is real. Don't let them fool you. For instance, today, all crimes, including murder, are categorized and addressed as commercial charges. This fact is officially acknowledged in Title 27 Code of Federal Regulations, Section 72.11. This single section of Title 27 confirms that undeniable supremacy and applicability of the UCC in all legal matters in every American courtroom. Now, let's take a look at where common law originated and how real it is.
Common law is a term used to refer to the main body of English unwritten law that evolved from the 12th century onward.
So keep in mind that common laws are the laws that English settlers brought over here and still do recognize. According to the Black Laws Dictionary, Editor-in-Chief Brian A. Garner, common law is defined as
the body of law derived from judicial decisions rather than from statutes or constitutions.
So you see, common law does exist. If it did not, then why is there a law that states that if a couple lives together for a certain amount of years, the two are considered married? According to the Black Laws Dictionary, Editor-in-Chief Brian A. Garner, common law marriage is defined as
a marriage that takes legal effect without license or ceremony. When a couple live together as husband and wife, intend to be married, and hold themselves out to others as a married couple.
Common law marriages are permitted in the 14 states and in the District of Columbia. And yes, Georgia is one of these states.
Now, there's two parts there or more to this.
It just takes quite a while. It's kind of interesting if you're interested in law things.
But knowing that we are under the UCC code.
Maritime law, I thought.
Actually, it's maritime law, but it's also the Uniform Commercial Code.
Yeah, I didn't really understand that.
We are we're corporations.
Hmm.
Each
of us is a corporation?
No, each of us is a member of a corporation, actually. All right? And we agree by having a driver's license or by having credit cards or whatever it is. But mostly, let's say driver's license, we are agreeing to uphold all the laws of the state, which is actually a corporation.
Connecticut is considered incorporated.
Right, and the federal government is actually incorporated.
Wow.
All right, so we are following statutes and laws based upon none that are totally unconstitutional, right?
Hmm.
Okay, and we became, I think it was 1865, right after the death of Lincoln, that we became a corporation. The United States became incorporated right after the Civil War, and we've been following that ever since. So kind of interesting, I thought. Now, this one, I thought I'd play this only because, but it's from Russian TV, but I never thought Russian TV would be more active, more
aggressive or advanced. More informed.
More informed, yeah. Okay, than the United States. And of course, the United States. The news media doesn't want you to know bullshit about what's going on.
Well, the reports of Libya mobilizing its air force against its own people spread quickly around the world. But Russia's military chief says that they've been monitoring from space, and the pictures tell a different story. Well, Artie Zelina Galushko can tell us more on this now. Arina, what are they saying?
Well, Alex, at this point, we have information from Russia's joint staff who are saying that they have been monitoring the situation in Libya from space via satellites since the beginning of the unrest in the country. And according to them, some of the reports made by the Western media are not entirely corresponding to the pictures that they are getting. To be more precise, according to Al Jazeera and to BBC, on the 22nd of February, Libyan government has inflicted airstrikes on Benghazi, the biggest city in the country, and on Tripoli. And according to Russia's military, they have not registered any of those air strikes. According to them, the pictures show that nothing of that sort has been going on the ground. Now, if we also focus on the pictures, on the footage that we've been getting from the country, we may be able to notice that there are absolutely no signs of any destruction inflicted by attacks from air or by Libyan Air Force in those pictures. So at this point, Russia's military is saying that as far as they are concerned, they have not seen any attacks, so they can pretty much make a judgment that those attacks, which the Western media has been reporting on have not been made. Also, Russian military is also working in very close cooperation with Russia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and they're monitoring not just the military situation, not just Tripoli and other cities in Libya. They're also paying very close attention to the oil extraction facilities, and they are keeping us up to date as to what is happening on the ground from space.
Okay, Irina, many thanks for the update. That was RT's Irina Galushka there reporting from Moscow on the Russian reaction to the Libyan conflict.
Of course, the Russians did support Libya and have supported them all along.
Well, so did, so have we.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted their oil.
But it's interesting.
Even though they were responsible for blowing up the...
several airlines.
Yeah, the airline.
Mm-hmm.
There was another one here I wanted to go to before. This one here.
Massive austerity budgets are destroying
America.
Yeah, probably true. This is by Kevin Zeiss.
Yeah, and this is... we've actually had Kevin on the show. He's an attorney. We've actually had him.
Yeah. He's a very bright man.
Yeah, and... It's a Global Research CA, and it says the race to the bottom has picked up its pace. As state and federal governments face budget deficits, they are cutting critical programs with austerity budgets that will weaken education, healthcare, essential services, and economy. Wisconsin is ground zero for the race to the bottom. It will.
I will be heading to Wisconsin the end of the week to get a better understanding of the situation and to gauge the anger. Has government finally hit the breaking point so people will stand up against the class war being perpetrated against them? I have no doubt that if the people were organized and demanded change, we could see the end of the corporate political duopoly that allows big business interests to dominate government and put profits ahead of people's needs. Maybe Wisconsin is a sign that the tipping point is here. I certainly hope so, because the richest country on earth does not need to be in a race to the bottom. We are in this race down because of choices the government is making for their wealthy campaign contributors.
Take Wisconsin. Not too long ago, the state was extremely well run with a budget surplus. The economic collapse, as it did for many states, created a budget deficit as expenditures rose and revenues declined. And now that the meager Obama stimulus is running out, the deficit is here. But in Wisconsin, the current deficit and future economic challenges are being made worse by choices made by the government. The Legislative Fiscal Bureau of Wisconsin, the state's official budget examiner, explained on January 31st how the state went from surplus to deficit. More than half of the lower estimated $117.2 million is due to the impact of special session Senate bill health savings accounts. Assembly Bill 3, tax deduction credits for relocated businesses, and Assembly Bill 7, tax exclusion for new employees.
Essentially, in a special session, the governor signed into law two business tax breaks and a tax break for health savings accounts. A conservative approach to health care, which primarily benefits the wealthy. This cost the state $117 million, and none of those costs were offset by other sources of income. This contributed to a budget already stressed by a bad economy and built significantly reduced revenues into future budgets.
So the
race to the bottom escalated. Comparisons were made between salaries for workers in private businesses and public workers in ways designed to produce biased results. When you look at age, education, hours worked, and other factors, a new study by the Economic Policy Institute indicates that Wisconsin public employees earn 4.8% less in total compensation per hour than comparable full-time employees in Wisconsin's private sector.
Of course, private industry has been in decline for years in the Midwest as unions shrunk. Good manufacturing jobs fled and were replaced by poor-paying service economy jobs. So as private industry declines, the public sector must keep pace and cut its salaries and benefits. In reality, Wisconsin's public workers have not seen major pay increases in recent years. They get paid more than private workers because of the race to the bottom. And Pulitzer Prize winning tax writer David Clay Johnson recently focused on one of the big lies of those encouraging the race down. They attempt to divide workers by claiming private workers pay the health and pension benefits of public workers. Johnson points out that out of every dollar of benefits, 100 cents is paid for by public workers who did not take pay increases in order to have adequate health and pension benefits.
Wisconsin is not the only state pushing workers down. As austerity measures take hold, public employees are under attack across the country by both parties. You hear that, folks? By both parties, with governors cutting jobs for essential services.
We have that right here in our state.
Yep.
The Democratic elected union-backed governor who's cutting jobs and benefits.
Cutting public jobs at a time of high unemployment will weaken the economy further. As the Economic Policy Institute writes, public sector workers' compensation is neither the cause nor can it be the solution to the state's financial problems. Only an economic recovery can begin to plug the hole in the state's budgets. Unfortunately, the state's own current budget balancing efforts may prolong the economic downturn by increasing unemployment and reducing demand for products and services.
You want to read more?
I'll read the next paragraph, then you can. The two big areas under attack are health benefits and pensions. Health benefits to workers are under attack across the nation. This could have been avoided if the federal health care overhaul actually solved the health care crisis rather than protected the insurance industry. Under a single-payer, improved Medicare for all system, money would be saved, health care products provided to all, and the driving force of deficits eliminated. Medicaid, health care for the poor, was projected to be the largest area of expansion of medical care under the Obama health care plan. That now seems like a mirage. Health benefits for the poor are being cut. More than half the states want permission to remove hundreds of thousands of people from Medicaid. Other states like New York and California, which are led by Democratic governors, are cutting benefits of health programs that already provide insufficient coverage. The health care crisis is worsening and driving deficits as the Obama plan takes hold. Let's see. Regarding pensions, the root of the crisis in the gambling casino known as Wall Street and the failure of governments to regulate it. A recent report by the Center for Economic and Policy Research found that most of the pension shortfalls using the current methodology is attributed to the plunge in the stock market in the years 2007 to 2009. They conclude that the size of the projected state and local government shortfalls measured as a share of future gross state products appears manageable. This is an exaggerated crisis that will create insecure retirements, increase poverty among retired Americans, and build into the economy a class of poor that will drag the U.S. economy down. For public workers, reneging on pensions means that they lose twice. As the Economist points out, they bargained for better pensions, giving up higher pay, and now the government is trying to get out of the contract.
In Wisconsin and Ohio, governors have gone further and challenged collective bargaining, sparking protests. Collective bargaining was a key balance to concentrated corporate capital in private industry, and has provided public workers with decent wages and benefits. The decline of private unions has coincided with wage stagnation and a growing wealth divide. As Nobel Prize winner in economics Paul Krugman recently wrote, if America has become more oligarchic and less democratic over the last 30 years, which it has, that's it to an important extent due to the decline of private sector unions. But the race to the bottom is much bigger than unions. The root causes of U.S. economic dysfunction is concentrated wealth and corporate political power that controls both political parties and the media, thereby preventing obvious solutions that would benefit the vast majority of Americans. Are Americans ready to really demand the change the United States needs? Rather than racing to the bottom, why aren't workers racing to the top, increasing their paltry and stagnant wages, ending inadequate health care, and insisting on retirement security? There is enough wealth in the country to achieve all of this, but it requires challenging the powers of concentrated wealth. And let's hope Wisconsin shows the tipping point has been reached and the people are ready. I agree with that.
By Kevin Zies, is executive director of Prosperity Agenda.
Yeah, Kevin is an attorney, and we've had him on our show a number of times.
And I agree with that.
Yeah.
He wrote that beautifully. I mean, kudos to you, Kevin. You really put everything right into perspective.
Yeah. And let's see. There was something else I wanted to. There was another thing I wanted to play here before we go to the L section. And this one here. This annoys the hell out of me because no news coverage on it, from any Western media, and that's because it's Iraq, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to read this, and this is from Ukrnet, .info, okay, Ukrnet.info, which is Arabian.
This is the article is by Marion
Wang. Okay, and there's a whole lot of, the funny thing is, a whole lot of American writers and journalists can't get an American press, and they're picked up by European and Middle Eastern press. ProPublica is the name of the website she writes for, and it's, as the Mideast protests and government crackdowns continue, one country to watch closely is Iraq, with whom the U.S. has a long-term partnership, and where clashes between protesters and government forces recently turned violent. Even as Iraq security forces detained and abused hundreds of intellectuals and journalists, the U.S. government, in keeping with a pattern of silence on Iraq's abuses, has withheld criticism of the strategic ally.
Asked generally about the violence against Iraq demonstrators on Friday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said only, "The approach we've taken with regard to Iraq is the same that we've taken with regard to the region," which he said was to call on governments to respond to the protests peacefully. Neither the White House nor the State Department seem to have mentioned the matter since. Yesterday's State Department briefing discussed Libya, Egypt, Iran, Oman, and Saudi Arabia, South Korea, China, Pakistan, Argentina, South Africa, and Haiti. Iraq was never discussed.
Nearly 30 people have been killed in the Iraqi unrest so far. And according to the Post, which noted that, unlike in other Mideast countries, the Iraqis are demanding better services and an end to corruption, not an end to the government. More on the brutal roundups from the Post. Four journalists who had been released described being rounded up well after they had left the protest of thousands of Baghdad Tahrir Square. They said they were handcuffed, blindfolded, beaten, and threatened with execution by soldiers from an army intelligence unit. One journalist told the Post that Iraqi soldiers were electric shocks on him.
Used
electric shocks.
It's far from the first time the government of Iraq has been accused of detaining and abusing citizens, including journalists. Allegations of abuse by the post-Saddam Iraq government have been made year after year, even at times by the U.S. government, which also had come to terms with its own detainee torture and abuse in American-run prisons in Iraq.
Last year, the Los Angeles Times uncovered a secret Baghdad prison where hundreds of Sunni men were detained and tortured by Iraqi security forces. They beat people. They use electricity, one Iraqi official told the Times. And Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki voted to shut the prison, saying, "Our reforms continue, and we have the Human Rights Ministry to monitor this. We will hold accountable anybody who has proven involved in such attacks." It's bullshit. This is the guy. Maliki is the guy who back in 2004 or 2003, 2004 before they actually set up a real government, he walked in and shot six shot dead right in front of us, six Iraqi, not Iraqi, six insurgents.
Yeah, nice guy.
I mean, this is the guy who's going to say no torture. This is a joke. All right.
Asked about the detention and torture of Iraqi forces in July 2010, a senior administration official said in a background briefing that the U.S. is engaged with Iraqis on these kinds of issues on a regular basis. The administration official noted that what was particularly striking was that the Iraqi government took corrective action and Iraqis are finding a way to use the political system. Months later, Amnesty International released another report detailing continued widespread abuse and torture in Iraqi prisons. And earlier this month, Human Rights Watch released a report that described yet another secret prison run by Malakai that was still operating. Iraqi government officials denied the report. Two Iraqi journalists told NPR their stories. One said he'd been imprisoned at a secret facility for 9 months. The other said his nephew was detained by Maliki's personal combat brigade, which reportedly controls the secret prison.
Asked earlier this month about the latest prison allegations, a U.S. military spokesman made clear that U.S. troops were not involved and referred further questions to Maliki's government, the Post responded, or reported.
Oh.
So, you know,
so much for
so
that.
This is the
so much for those lies.
This is the crap that's going on in Iraq. And there's a picture of some poor bastard getting, you know, gotten beat up.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, give me a break. Yeah, break. Let's see. I wanted to do some health issues tonight. There was one more here that I think I saw. I think we covered it. All right. What I wanted to do was go to some health issues. But I'd like to take a little music break before
while we bring that up, we look for
all
that.
All right. So hang on 1 second.
We'll give you a little music. Which one do you have here?
I don't know. Would you like to hear the whole Swagger song? Or would you like to hear Burnt Rubber? Or maybe... I always like this.
Burnt Rubber is nice.
Yeah, and that one's all good, too. That's a good song.
All You Can Eat, that's good.
Yeah. So what would you like to hear?
All You Can Eat.
That was the Cajun kind of...
Yeah, that was cool. I like that
one.
Yeah.
like to hear one more. There's a, I got one more that, short one.
No, we could listen to
it. It's not bluesy. I forgot which one this is, but I think it was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. there's a couple more that I wanted to read here. Oops. Hang on a second.
Oh, Leo just lost it.
It's very tricky.
It's the wrong button here.
Very, very tricky, this, these buttons. I got way too many.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Let's see. That there was another one that was really interesting that I wanted to read. 40 million Americans have work-related anxiety disorder. But there was another one that was here. Where is it? Food prices. This guy. There was about kids' allergies. Were due to the lack of vitamin D.
Oh, you don't see it.
Here's one. Poor childhood diet lowers intelligence in later life.
Well, that makes sense. Most people understand the importance of a well-balanced diet, including the minimum daily requirements of vitamins and minerals to prevent chronic disease. These critical cofactors of life are repeatedly shown to promote health and prevent a myriad of chronic diseases from diabetes to dementia to heart disease and cancer. The impact of proper nutrition on a child's developing brain is brought to light in a study published in the British Medical Journal. A processed food diet packed with sugar, fat, excessive salt can lower IQ in early childhood, while eating a diet filled with naturally healthy food that provides a full complement of vitamins and nutrients is shown to benefit cognitive development.
The study results were based on the Avon longitudinal study of parents and children involving 14,000 children born in 1991 and 92. Based on parent questionnaires, children were placed in one of three dietary groups based on eating patterns. Processed, including excessive fats, sugars, and salt. Traditional, based on high quantities of meat and vegetables, and health conscious, that stressed salads, fruits, vegetables, rice, and pasta.
IQ was measured at the age of 8.5 using the standardized Wechsler intelligence scale for children. Researchers found that children eating the most processed food diet at age 3 scored 1.67 IQ points lower for each 1-point increase in dietary patent score. Similarly, those eating the most healthful diet scored 1.2 IQ points higher for every 1-point improvement in dietary patent score.
I got a question, not only because, you know, the parents that are going are more, you know, a lot of IQ is based on parental and social upbringing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, guys, kids who...
On the culture that they live in.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, if you're
the parents who are more health food conscious tend to have more money and be rich and have better jobs.
And better educated. And the people that are straight out, you know, processed foods and stuff are less.
Diet was found to have no effect on IQ score after the age of 4. The study underscores the importance of proper nutrition on developing brains. Prior research has shown an association between early childhood diet and later behavior and school performance. The research author noted, this suggests that any cognitive behavioral effects relating to eating habits in early childhood may well persist into late childhood despite any subsequent changes to dietary intake.
Well, they know that too, that malnutrition in a third
caused
world caused
permanent damage.
I messed that up again.
Yeah, you're not paying attention.
Well, I'm kicking the wrong button. I don't know why exactly.
Because you keep fooling with that.
Yeah.
Just leave it.
Go up there.
I wanted to read,
did I have this blog talk now? All right, hang on 1 second.
Just push that down. Make it smaller. Don't do that.
Right,
just make this smaller so we don't lose it.
Okay.
No, not larger, smaller. Minimize. Okay.
No, I just did that.
Oh, all right.
I did that. You do that by doing that.
Okay.
But I wanted to...
go to Blog Talk.
Yeah. Go back to our site here, folks.
Oh, we have... have a whole bunch of, I want to read.
Yeah, there's a few, there's quite a few more.
Yeah.
Work-related anxiety.
I'd like to read food prices to skyrocket, riots could follow, suggests USDA, and I think that it's important to read.
Okay.
Just let us get back to our site that we have to get back to, and then I can read that.
Bear with us, folks. Bear with us. Okay. I just wanted to check, make sure everything is fine. We have 8 minutes left. Okay, I'm going to go back down there. Then I have to go.
That's why I told you to put it on minimize.
I know. Sorry, folks, for the delay.
He doesn't do it. He does it the long way. So this is very inefficient.
Very inefficient, yes, dear. I thought, hang on one second here. This
is very annoying.
Very annoying.
I would not do it like that.
Okay,
let's go down to, want to read that article. Keep going. It's on food costs. Yeah.
Right,
food prices skyrocket. Riots could follow. This is an interesting one. And who's this by? Let's give credit where credit is due. Jonathan Benson, staff writer for
Natural News.
When the upswing in commodity prices eventually makes its way throughout the food system in mid to late 2011, food prices are sure to spike with levels potentially reaching those of 2008, announced the USDA. Economist Ephraim Liebtag at the agency's annual Outlook Forum. And if conditions escalate rapidly, there is also the potential for food riots and other civil unrest. The USDA is predicting a 3.5% increase in food prices in 2011.
That's
huge,
still, yeah.
Which is about twice the overall
inflation rate,
but less than the 2008 increase, according to a recent Reuters report. In 2008, food prices rose 5.5%. which represents the highest increase since 1990, but the possibility of food prices dramatically rising in 2011 like they did in 2008 is a definite possibility.
Given that it's still earlier in the year, I'm prone to be conservative on the side of the forecast, said Liebtag, but it's a possibility, he added, concerning the likelihood of massive inflation in food costs like we've seen in 2008. Liebtag also explain the agency's expectation of a 4% rise in cost for meat, poultry, and fish, a 3.5% increase for fruits and vegetables, or 4% increase for cereals and bakery products, and a 3% increase in sugars and sweets costs. All increases represent anywhere from a 20 to 60% increase over last year's increases.
In 2008, food shortages and rapid price increases led to riots in 25 different countries around the world. And the same may happen again, including here in the U.S., due to factors like the devaluation of the dollar, crop losses, rising oil costs, and other economic factors. The warning serves as a wake-up call to Americans to take back their land and begin growing more food on local and a regional scale. According to statistics from FarmAid, a family farming advocacy group, roughly 5 million U.S. farmers have been lost since 5 million U.S. farms have been lost since the 1930s, and about 330 farmers every week leave the land.
500 million U.S. farms.
Yeah. It's all been bought up by those factory farms. If this trend continues, the situation will only worsen. Factory farming, which is this next paragraph, operations have essentially replaced local farming throughout the country, and government policies like subsidization of genetically modified crops only continues to drive small-scale farmers off the land and exacerbate the problem. To learn more about how to support local farming and regain food independence, visit farmaid.org.
Okay. So that's kind of important.
Yeah, that's scary.
Let's see. We've got enough time for one more. You sent them for colds, coughs, and diabetes.
Yeah, I knew about that.
You did?
Mm-hmm. But they're not sure whether that works or not.
This spice cinnamon has long been used in both cooking medicine since Egyptian times. I didn't know about it, so I'm going to read it.
Okay.
If I can find it ever again. Finally, somebody said it. Diesel fumes pose cancer risk. If anybody's been behind a bus or a...
We've shut off our buses. They can't idle their engines in front of the school.
Yeah, I mean, on February 4th, International Union Against Cancer Day, the World Health Organization reported that cancer will kill 84 million people by 2015. Of the deadly cancers, lung cancer is the leading killer. Smoking is known to be the single most important factor of the development of the disease. Environmental pollution also plays a role in the development of cancers, particularly ordinary traffic pollution, largely made up of carbon dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, and particulate matter from diesel fumes.
One of the first studies to link traffic pollution with lung cancer and heart disease was published in the Journal of American Medical Association in 2002, based on a 16-year study of 500,000 individuals. The study, headed by the environmental science expert C. Arden Pope, was just one in a long line providing the link between cancer risk and traffic pollution. And this prompted the Environmental Protection Agency to limit the fine particulate matter in the air.
Soot measuring 2.5 microns and 15 microns per cubic meter. The International Agency for Research on Cancer declared diesel fumes to be a Class 2A carcinogen in 1989, which means they probably are carcinogenic to humans. In 2005, the Clean Air Task Force eliminates that diesel fumes are responsible for the death of approximately 21,000 U.S. citizens each year. Diesel fumes are made up of a complex mix of chemicals in the form of soot and gas. And how these chemicals react with each other, with one another during combustion, can turn them into potential cancerous agents. And polycyclic aromatic
hydrocarbons
are formed when burning diesel fuel, and it is these which are classed as probable carcinogens when the nitrogen oxide fumes mix with PAH or whatever. They can become highly carcinogenic. Diesel fuel is not the only source of PAH. There are also forms of char grilling, barbecuing meat, smoking tobacco, burning garbage, and burning coal, oil, or gas.
A study out of Spain in July 2007 concluded that living in a city of more than 100,000 for more than 40 years was associated with an increased risk in the development of bladder cancer. Another study out of Canada in 2008 found an increased risk of developing non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in people who work regularly with diesel combustion engines, namely farmers and machinists. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is one of the blood cancers which is on the rise.
I just want to mention, we got 1 minute before we go out. If anybody wants to call to hear the end of the show, otherwise you can pick it up in the archives. And at the end of this, one natural food that can help the body eliminate pollution is chlorella.
Chlorella
is a powerful antitoxin and detoxifier, and it is particularly helpful for smokers or those subject to chronic pollution, such as city dwellers. Zeolite is another powerful detoxifier that one should be careful to only choose the clinopatolite
form,
which can be taken in odorless drops.
Well,
so you want to get zeolite, okay?
Yeah.
That's what I need.
Well, it's 9 o'clock.
Yep, and the show is complete.
And we want to
thank
you.
Streaming, but
yep.
We want to thank everybody for joining us. And we're going to play us out.
Yep, and join us again.
Join me tomorrow night. Tomorrow's Lila's night off, and when we enter the fourth dimension. And J. enjoy Friday night with Lila and George Dixon and myself, and as we discuss the many
as we are in the fourth dimension.
We stay within the fourth dimension.
All right, so, folks. Good night and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Yes.